Swimming is much more than an Olympic event. According to 2017 data, 27 million Americans swim for fitness. Similar data is reported from English cities, where more than 4 million men and women swim at least once a month. USA Swimming, the national governing body for the sport in the United States, has 400,000 members and 2,800 teams in the country. Howard Means has just authored the new book, Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming, and he joins us this morning to tell us about this fascinating sport, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Howard Means to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Joe. I appreciate it.
What got you interested in swimming?
Well, I've been swimming my whole life, and that's a long life at this point. And I won my first race when I was 5 years old, not because I was the fastest swimmer, but I was the only one who could dive in. Everybody else had to jump in and push off the wall, so I had a big head start. And I swam through high school, swam through college, coached for 7 years, and I've kept swimming ever since. And, you know, so they say write about what you know. And I'd written a whole bunch of books about things I didn't know. And they were kind of journeys of discovery, which made them interesting to do. And I thought, well, I'll try writing a book about something I know inside out. But, of course, I didn't know it inside out. And the book itself turned into a journey of discovery as well as a labor of love. So it was a delight to write, I got to say.
When you are taking on something like this, I mean, it's so 10,000 years is what it says in the subtitle. Did you intend to go back that far and to research it that far back?
No, I got no. I went searching for the first reference. I thought, well, you know, it's if it's going to be basically a kind of a history of swimming, why not start with the earliest reference? And I kept finding, I go back, and there was something in the book of Isaiah, and something further and further. And then I stumbled upon, and I actually knew about this place before because it's featured in the movie The English Patient from the late 90s, the one, the best picture. I think it was 99, but I can't remember exactly. At any rate, stumbled upon this place called the Cave of the Swimmers in the southwest Egyptian desert, where the oldest known cave paintings or pictographs of swimmers are found. And they're clearly, I mean, there's some debate among scholars about what exactly they're doing in this scene, but they're clearly doing the doggy paddle. There's no question about it. You can see it. It's pretty obvious. So then, you know, the question comes up, why were people swimming in the desert? And so, you know, that then spawns a whole new line of inquiry in which you discover that the Africa, that was the what's known as the African humid period, when the Earth had shifted on its axis, wobbled on its axis slightly about 12,000 years ago. And all those heavy rains and sort of tropics that we associate with, say, Central Africa, the Congo area, had all moved northward, I should say, into what's now the Sahara, the Great Sand Sea, which was then not quite a great sea, but it was filled with lakes, it was filled with river systems, and at this spot that is now, and this is what really blew me away when I discovered it, the driest spot on Earth as measured by the aridity index, Wadi Sura in the southwest Egyptian desert, are the oldest known paintings of swimmers. So, you know, how could I not? How could I not go with that as an opener?
Absolutely, it is fascinating. Maybe this is just semantics. I don't know. Is it important to think of swimming one way or the other when it comes to it being a sport or an activity?
Yeah, it's a really interesting. It's a good question, actually. The Greeks, for example, did not include it in the ancient games, the ancient Greek games. That was wrestling and track and field events. But the Greeks considered it literally a civic virtue to be able to swim. Plato once said that a man is not educated until he can read, write, and swim. Think of that. Wouldn't that be wonderful if we had that in our own day? Wouldn't that be good for water safety, too, for that matter? It reemerges. We'll talk about this later, but the swimming just disappears for 1,000 years after the fall of Rome. The Greeks, the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, the ancient Egyptians, they were all wonderful swimmers. They were Mediterranean people. And, you know, if you've ever been around the Mediterranean, it's hard not to dive, just take your clothes off and dive in. It's so beautiful. And then swimming disappears when it reappears in England in about the early 17th century, let me say, when it reappears then, it reappears because the people are looking back what made Rome, what made Greece unique, And one of the things that made them unique, as far as England, you know, as far as the British in the 18th, 17th century were concerned, was the fact that they swam. Nobody swam in the continent. Nobody swam in Europe. In England, almost nobody swam. So they rediscovered, and England's also always been betting crazy. And so the first races are purse races. The first races of which anybody can find an account are purse races, including an early one in the 1792, I think, in the Thames River, where the winner won the equivalent of what is now about $1,200, and he celebrated by drinking himself to death that very night. For much of the 19th century, there were lots of races in England. Most of them were handicap races, purse races, I mean, swimming for money, diving in for dollars.
In the introduction, I gave a couple of statistics of how many people swim, which is an amazing number. Let's talk about the people who don't because of the fear of it, of yeah. what there is about swimming that so many people are fearful of.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, there was a long period for which people didn't swim because they were afraid of spirits in the water and various things like that. And in our own time, it's really this is nothing that fascinated me when I saw it, and I had to go and figure out why. The lowest swimming literacy rate in America, which is to say the people who drown in the greatest numbers, are African Americans and Native Americans. If you go back to the record, European travelers to America and Africa in the colonization period in Africa and in the settlement of America were constantly astounded by what spectacular swimmers coastal Africans and Native Americans were. I mean, everybody said who saw them, well, they're so far much farther advanced, further advanced than we are today. And so what happened? Well, what happened is they unlearned to swim. Both American African Americans and Native Americans unlearned to swim over four or five generations because of all the socioeconomic factors that are tied into swimming as well. Access to pool, access to schools where they teach you to swim, all that sort of stuff. Time to swim, various other things. So what we have now is disproportionate by far, and the results are horrifying sometimes. There was an instance down in Arkansas in the Red River about a decade ago in which two African-American families were picnicking, bright sunny day, and the children, they were all teenagers, there were seven of them, go walking along a sandbar, and all of a sudden the front one drops off because the sandbar stops. He's floundering. All his cousins go in and try to rescue him sequentially, and every one of them except for the first person to go in drowns. The person who the first one to go in is finally rescued by a guy on the shore. And the horror of it is that all the people on shore, the aunts, the uncles, the fathers, the mothers, were too terrified to dive in to save him or even form a kind of a human chain, which is what you would normally do in a situation like that. So that fear of water is horrible, and it's all psychological. I mean, if you just hold your breath and lie down in the water, you can't sink. Your lungs are as good as an inner tube, and so it's just the fear that causes people to make irrational actions when they're submerged in water, and that is to try to breathe instead of just fighting your way to the surface. So all that, one chapter is a crusade on that front because I feel it really strongly. You have to teach swimming to kids. There's no sense in anyone's drowning. There really isn't. Benjamin Franklin, by the way, felt the same way. He was a real crusader for swimming education and was really one of the people who revived swimming in the English-speaking world. In fact, in Europe as well as in the English-speaking world, he was a very accomplished swimmer. And when he was in his 20s, if you ask him, he would strip off his clothes and dive into the River Thames and show you what a good swimmer he was. Roll in the water, performs all sorts of tricks. Wouldn't it be fun if there were video cams of that?
Well, fun and disturbing, probably.
Yeah,
Howard.
Good point.
Howard Means is the author of Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming. It is published by Hachette. You know, one of the things that becomes very clear in the book is just how much, like all good subjects, I guess, of just how much it relates to our society. So there are so many components, whether it be fashion or architecture or religion or sanitation and public health and segregation and integration. And there's just so much there, which I assume for you is just a treasure trove. And yet, I ask you as the author, how you rein it all in.
Oh, boy. And that, again, was part of the process of discovery. You know, the more I thought about it, the more I realized I'm not writing a book about swimming. I'm writing a book about 10,000 years of history through the single lens of swimming. And so that's really what I, you know, and so I tried to keep swimming at the center of everything I did, but you had to stop and look at the side everywhere you went along. And so, you know, swimming costumes change. Victorian women swam in costumes that guaranteed they would never learn to swim. They had skirts down to their ankles and in the water to keep the skirt from rising up in the water. They had lead weights sewn into the hems. Well, try swimming with lead weights in a skirt and, you know, kicking with that. It would be like resistance training today that an Olympic aspirant might do. So you have that, and then the clothes come off. And why do the clothes come off? Well, they come off because society is changing, and, you know, attitudes towards the human body are changing. But they also come off because miracle fibers are being invented, and the invention of the bikini, for example, it emerges just after World War II in France. In part, it's a response to the absence of the shortage of materials. And so, you know, designers were, you know, taxed with the problem of how do you make a swimming suit if you don't have enough material to make it. And then a guy named Louis Rayard had the bright idea of making a swimming suit, making a skimpy swimming suit just for the pleasure of having a skimpy swimming suit. And he sort of, you know, he scandalized Paris when he debuted this in 1945. And he called it the bikini after the island atoll in the Pacific that the U.S. had just conducted the first nuclear tests on. So he got attention that way. And then eventually he said it was modeled by a stripper from a dance club near the pool where he debuted it, because he couldn't find a Paris model, a runway model, who was willing to be seen in such an outfit. And this woman, Michelle Bernardini, if I'm remembering that correctly, Micheline Bernardini, received 50,000 letters when the photograph was finally sent around the world, many of them proposals of marriage. So then, you know, it goes from there. But just that sort of everything's interrelated. I mean, you know, it's not just about fashion. It's about materials. It's about war, which... Well, what happened with the bathing suit initially in the United States was when World War I came along, there was no domestic rayon industry. It was all German industry. World War I comes along and there's no rayon because the ports are all being embargoed. And so the U.S. creates a rayon industry. And what's rayon going to be used for? Well, it's going to be used for swimming suits, among other things. So all this is interrelated. And it was just so much fun to pull one thread in swimming and see what came out.
When you think about this activity, the sport of swimming, what is the state of it right now? Is it in good shape, do you think?
Oh, I think it's in wonderful shape. For those of us who like to swim regularly, it's in too good a shape, because it's hard to find an empty lane sometimes. Right. When you want to go get a workout. No, I mean, I think and especially people like Michael Phelps and Katie Ledecky, and some of the new people, Caleb Dressel, who's just unbelievably fast, have made it a sort of a glamour sport, I think. And my book was you know, hopefully, I'd hoped it would come out on, you know, to be sort of tied into the Summer Olympics. It's not going to be tied into that for obvious reasons. But that also there's a point of sorrow in all that, too, for me, because these people have worked so hard to get themselves to this moment, this one moment in time when, you know, they're going to be at the peak performance, and it's taken away from them by the coronavirus in this case. And this happened in 1980 when Jimmy Carter canceled U.S. and pulled the U.S. out of the Moscow Olympics for geopolitical reasons. Rowdy Gaines is one of the people he pulled out, who went on to become famous as an Olympic commentator. And he told me that I think the number is there were 371 people who had qualified for those 1980 Olympics who had not qualified in 1976 and would not qualify again in 1984. This is in all sports. And imagine these are 371 people who had their chance just to go and compete in the Olympics and never got it. It's kind of heartbreaking. So I really hope that they'll have them in 2021, not just for my sake, but for the sake of all these athletes who've trained so hard to get ready for that moment.
And
but, you know, the world is filled with swimming right now. It's wonderful.
And it is, the Olympics, I mean, is one of the greatest, and not just for swimming, but is one of the greatest boosters of sport, right? I mean,
yes,
it just because it puts it on the world stage.
Yeah. And it gives, you know, there's that 3 week period when, you know, everybody's television is turned that way. It's like an endless Final Four competition.
Well,
it's upset sometimes, too.
That's right. Howard Means is the author of the new book, Splash. It is published by Hachette. Howard Means, thank you so much for sharing with us. Fascinating history, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Best of luck for the week. Thanks for having me, Joe. Really appreciate it. Great interview. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Splash, 10,000 Years of Swimming by Howard Means. It's published by Hachette. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.